Thanks for taking the time to download this BBC Radio 5 Live podcast. To find other programmes you might be interested in, click bbc.co.uk/5live, where you'll also find our terms of use.
Hello and welcome to another entertaining programme from BBC Radio 5 Live, all about movie reviews and Mark losing his marbles. I should tell you that today's podcast features some of the most irritating broadcasting you have ever. I mean, I know we do it a lot, but believe me, by the time we get to the end of the programme, you will thank the good Lord that we've finished. It is truly, truly terrifying.
Are we going to put that on the poster?
Anyway, David Joffe writes, now that you seem to be reading out emails in the preamble to the podcast...
This wasn't in the programme.
I thought it might be worth pointing out that its opening jingle ends a clause with a preposition. The jingle says, to find other programmes you might be interested in.
Oh!
It should be
to find other programs in which you might maybe be interested.
But they'll include it anyway. Yes. Keep up the entertainment. So what's coming up?
Reviews of Tron Legacy, Burlesque, Catfish, and of course Fred the Movie, which is the reason that you've been saying that this is the most irritating.
That
and of course
comes we have, up at the end of this podcast. I'd leave 5 minutes.
We have a lovely guest as well.
The guest is Mark Strong, star of The Way Back, and very fine he is. And let the wittertainment commence. Elizabeth Campbell says, an opportunity has arisen. Following your recent conversations about the best universities in the country, I thought I might suggest a compromise. The position of Chancellor has become available at the actual best university in the country, Durham.
Durham.
I would like to propose that your good selves adopt a timeshare of the position. At the very least, you would have an avenue for the implementation of the Code of Conduct, given that there is an active student film society which regularly puts on screenings of recent films. Admittedly, the venue is not always very comfortable, but it's not quite sainthood, says Elizabeth, but you would be following in fine footsteps Messrs. Ustinov and Bryson, and would get to wear rather fetching gowns at ceremonies. Let the campaign begin. Should we put ourselves forward to be chancellors of Durham University?
What does being a chancellor involve? Surely it's an official...
You probably get given a cabbage of the year by the Freeman of Durham.
Yes.
And you get to wear robes.
Okay. Well, haven't you been given the freedom of a city somewhere?
No, I haven't. No, I have not.
You got something. You got some...
An honorary doctorate. Do you remember it annoyed
you
intensely?
No, I remember that. But didn't you get something else? You got some other award for being yourself.
A Sony Award?
No. I remember that very well.
Do you? Now, so are we interested?
Yeah, I mean, in the words of Nigel Tufnell from Spinal Tap, I don't know, what are the hours?
Stephen says, dear James Cameron and 3D, my girlfriend Eva and I work for an Odeon, which recently underwent an IMAX facelift just in time for HP 7A.
Cool.
As you may already know, a disclaimer must be read out to all those in the screen, informing them that because this film is not in 3D, you will not need 3D glasses.
No.
I'm just reading Stephen's email.
No, that can't be real.
It's quite funny if it is. Thankfully, says Stephen, it's not my job to do the public speaking, but it is Eva's. She has to make the announcement. She isn't the biggest film fan, but she still enjoys your show, and much to my enjoyment has begun starting her speeches to the assembled with hello, Muggles, and hello, Jason Isaacs. So if you could say hello to Eva, that would be a great early Christmas present.
Hello, Eva.
Well, I can't quite believe that an audience has to be addressed to be told it's not in 3D, therefore they will not need their glasses.
No, that really is astonishing. Although I would love to see somebody going in to see Harry Potter 7A, Harry on Camping, bringing their own 3D glasses, watching the whole movie in 3D, and then going, you know, it's incredible. After a while, I just stopped thinking about it being in 3D.
We are being live-streamed. You can watch the fun, and you can see when Mark Strong is led in just a few minutes.
That would
time.
Be the moment to turn on the live-stream. Until then, it's just two old guys.
One of whom is drinking a coffee. Tim says...
Can we get a coffee for Mr. Mayo, please?
Tim Stoner. What a great name. Mark... The reason that they won't give you a big microphone, see previous programmes, is because every time you talk, you bang the thing. Please stop it. You are deafening everyone.
Right. If you can see from the cameras there, right, here's the point. My microphone is standing on the table, so when I bang the table, you hear it. Simon's big microphone is on a stand which is mounted not on the table but elsewhere, so Simon can bang the table and it doesn't reverberate through the big microphone. That's because he has got preferential treatment.
John Sr. in Tokyo, in the last two podcasts, I've noticed that Dr. K has developed an annoying habit, brackets, yes, another one. Instead of the correct third-person plural pronoun, themselves, he has begun inexplicably to say themself. This word does not exist. My linguistics professor taught us it was created as a non-gender specific alternative to himself and herself, but using it with a plural noun is simply wrong. As Churchill might have said, this is the kind of semi-post-feminist grammar up with which
I shall not put,
says John. And by the way, people in Japan don't take their shoes off in the cinema unless the cinema also happens to be someone's home, which in my experience is very rare.
Well, I'm trying to think when I've said themselves. I'm sure that I'm being corrected on. I'm sure that's right. Well, I will. So what they're saying is you can't say themselves. They can only be themselves.
But not themselves.
But not themselves.
This from Stephen Robinson, MSc Environmental Management. Further to your email on last week's programme regarding the learned gentleman who loudly requested where the monsters were in the film entitled Monsters. More of which later when we do the top 10 rundown. I'm writing to express my concern. I don't believe this gentleman is alone, and that there is a growing number of people who take the title of a movie as a literal description of its content. Whilst this is perfectly fine for any superhero or Harry Potter movie, problems are encountered in other films. I call on the Wittertainment Nation to assist members of the public in identifying such films, and even suggesting alternative titles for these films to be known. Here, and then feel free to yell out loudly. Independence Day, for example, should be renamed Aliens Attack. It's not a film about the freedom of America. In fact, Independence Day itself only turns up in the last half hour. Green Zone is Born 4, not a movie about a region where fossil fuels are banned. Night and Day, Carry On Mission Impossible. Salt is Girl Born. Unstoppable is clearly stoppable. Was that a spoiler? Blatant false advertising. Yes. But if you say unstoppable, clearly it shouldn't be stopped.
Yes. Well,
and if it is stopped, then it's not unstoppable.
Yeah, I agree.
You see what the problem is.
So, but the problem with it is that Denzel Washington starring in a film called Stoppable is a harder sell, really, isn't it?
After a while, all things stop.
But then, as you said, like you know, the taking of Pelham 123 brackets, but they get it back in the end, only not in one piece.
Black Swan is also, he suggested, should just be called Ballet Dancing Can Be Stressful.
Have you seen Black Swan yet?
I haven't seen Black Swan.
Oh, you've got such a treat.
I haven't seen Made in Dagenham yet.
Really?
Oh, don't come all Stephen Woolley on me.
Okay, fine. And from henceforth, being a little bit tetchy will be known as coming over all Stephen Woolley.
Oh, I'm coming over all Stephen Woolley. It's a hot flush. It was a very Kenneth Williams sequence,
it was,
that last
it?
30 seconds.
I'm Sandy, and this is my friend Stephen.
Dear Doctors Good and Pedantic, says Matt, can I suggest Encounters at the End of the World by Dr. K's favourite Bavarian misanthrope? I recently watched it as part of my plan to figure out what Kermode is on about. Also on the list, lots of Ken Loach, and found myself laughing out loud when Werner Herzog does his fluffy penguins line, as I wasn't expecting it to be a direct quotation. Apologies if you read this out and it leads to accents.
No, he really does. He really does say in the thing, you know, I'm going to go to the Antarctic, but I don't want any fluffy penguins. No fluffy penguins for me. No, I am Werner Herzog. I don't want the fluffy penguins. I want fear, mutilation, death, chaos, disorder, you know, that.
Just gone into Python there. Matt says, P.S. I've tried my best with the grammar, but trying to learn Russian has taught me that English people of my age, born 1985, from state schools, weren't taught the structure of our own language properly at all. So Dr. K's pedantry is sort of bullying, given that he was fortunate enough to have his early education paid for. This is not a dig, just a plea for patience towards people whose intellectual lives begin a step behind.
OK. So I'm bullying because I was privileged enough to have grown up with the fabulous world of paid-for education, and now...
That's the one.
Is that, okay, fine. It is like the 80s all over again, though, isn't it? I was just in contact with somebody who I was in a band with in the 1980s. I said, look, you know, rioting students in the street, mass unemployment, everything's falling, but let's form the band again.
Doctor Who on the telly?
Exactly.
And Dan...
Tron in the cinemas.
Indeed. What more could you ask for? Dan Keating... science degree in business, he says. Yes, I'm confused by that as well. This Friday, 17th of December, I will be sitting the first of my Christmas exams, and I will either need to be congratulated or commiserated, depending on how I will fare. No matter what will happen, you can be guaranteed that hearing the good doctors wish me luck in my exams will make my day, week, month, year, decade, and so on, into infinity. So that's down to you then, Dan Keating.
What was the gesture? Like that, you sort of gestured towards the control room.
That was a gesture to the control room to indicate in a quiet manner that would not be noticed to bring in our guest.
Oh, I see. I'm sorry, I thought that you were gesturing towards... Hello, Mark. So who are we saying good luck to?
Do you not pay attention?
No, I do. But it was it Dan?
It's Dan Keating who's got big exams today,
and he's doing the science of.
No,
business.
He's already got that. Never mind. Mark
good
Strong is here.
You.
Thank heavens
Mark,
for that.
Make you say good luck to Dan.
Good luck, Dan. Yes. All the best, mate.
Thank you. And you said that with the sincerity of a trained voiceover artist.
Thank you very much. Yes.
The outside when we came in, Mark referred to me as Marky, which caught me completely off guard because nobody other than the good Mrs. Doctor ever calls me Marky. And it was the good Mrs. Professor now. And it was
Do
really
Do you call
strange.
Her the good Mrs. Professor? That would be great. Hi, I'm home, good Mrs. Professor.
I call her sir.
But I'm a Marky, you see, so I see it as a term of endearment and affection.
But
and
does
respect.
Everyone call you Marky, or do just only special people? Because I'm not going to call you Marky.
Only special people. I mean, yeah, you can't get a stranger. I'd be worried.
Yes.
Enormously presumptuous to say Marky Strong, isn't it? That would seem disrespectful.
It's like Marky Smith.
I never had a nickname. So it was either Marky or Strongy was the best that anyone could ever come up with.
Oh, I had a nickname.
What was
Spiny
it?
Norman. Because I had a sort of flat top and they thought I looked like the imaginary hedgehog in Monty Python, and it wasn't meant affectionately either.
So when you were at school, you never had a nickname?
No, Strongy was the best they
Strongy.
Could come up with.
Marky Strongy.
Do you know what I mean?
What was the name of your college?
What, my school?
Yeah.
Wyndham College.
Yeah, Wyndham College, that's right. So this says, my brother reckons he used to beat up Mr. Strong at school.
Unlikely.
Can you ask him to confirm this? The protagonist would have been one William Ottaway of Wyndham College. This is from Simon Ottaway.
I do remember the name William Ottaway, but I never really had many fights at school.
Well, William Ottaway is clearly going through life claiming that he used to beat you up at school, as though that's anything to be proud about anyway.
Well, if he feels good about it, he can get away with that. But I remember one particular fight where the guy cunningly pulled my blazer up over my head and started to be punching underneath it. I couldn't get out. That was the only time I ever remember being beaten up.
That might have been William Ottaway.
Could have been.
Yeah, but that's not really something to be proud of.
No, absolutely not. No, but if you could see Mark now, and he looks lean and mean and you know, fantastic, and looks like he's just escaped from a gulag, which is something he singularly
would
fails
be great
to do
though if
film.
There was a scene in the next movie in which you're playing a really hard person that you pull their blazer up over their head and then punch them repeatedly underneath.
But what a brilliant tactic!
It's
don't you
fantastic.
Think, as far as
yeah, pick
fights.
Someone your own age, not 11-year-old kids.
No, quite.
Is a reference to Kick-Ass, by the way.
Yes, I know.
Yeah, I was just explaining it because people go, what, Mark goes around attacking 11-year-old kids? But
Marky.
only in films.
For the purpose of this...
Marky
this
and Mark.
Marky and yeah, Mark. Yeah. So we can be together, Marky Mark, which is what I've always wanted to be.
OK, well, Simon Ottaway, thanks for the tweet about that. Apparently it's not true and your violent brother should be thoroughly ashamed of himself
quite.
For claiming to be a bully.
Absolutely.
Mark Strong is our guest. The Way Back is his new film. It's a very, very cold film. In fact, last week we were talking about, this is because a listener had said, you know, what's the best cold film to watch if it's very cold outside and you want to be even colder inside? Joe Cobb says, I suspect Tom Hanks et al. Were a little on the chilly side floating around a tin can during the making of Apollo 13, because that was out in space, presumably. That's,
yes.
That's extremely cold. Tom Goodfellow in Sydney... says, on the subject of the coldest movies ever, I believe I can provide the definitive answer in the form of philosophical hunting movie Zero Kelvin, starring Stellan Skarsgård. Not only is the story almost entirely set in an Arctic hut in winter, the very title of the film is the definition of the coldest temperature scientifically possible. So Zero Kelvin...
Not a lot colder than that.
Is it minus 273? Or something.
I love the
God,
fact
no
that
idea.
You looked to me for some... Yes, it is. It is minus 273.
Is that what it is?
Yeah.
And Kevin, in freezing in Winnipeg... on last week's podcast, I heard you talking about the coldest movies. As I currently live in what seems to be the coldest city outside Siberia, Winnipeg, Canada, I am uniquely qualified to weigh in on this topic. I would suggest the two coldest films were filming recently in Winnipeg, The Turgid and Vile New in Town, wherein the deep frozen Renée Zellweger's face it actually freezes into a perpetual rodentine visage. Cue Mark impersonation.
Well, do you want me to do it? No, I think it's fine.
And the equally awful Whiteout, which is about murder in an Arctic research station, although it features the most gratuitous
That's
scene
right, yeah.
ever, in which Kate Beckinsale has to strip out of her Arctic gear into skimpy underwear to take a shower, which on the face of it, says Kevin, isn't such a bad thing.
It's also worth suggesting the Guy Maddin film My Winnipeg, in which there is, and I remember when I saw this, wondering, because Guy Madden is just an incredible filmmaker. He's got a kind of David Lynch sensibility to him. But he made this film, My Winnipeg, which is a sort of fictional history of Winnipeg. And one of the things is an episode in it which looks like it must have been made up, in which these horses were running across a stream and the stream froze and the horses' heads sort of formed this strange frozen landscape, and all that winter people would go and sit on them. And you think he must have made this up, but apparently he didn't. Apparently really it is a thing that's true. I mean, if somebody's listening in Winnipeg and can tell me that's not true, as far as I understand, the section in My Winnipeg in which there is a landscape of frozen horses' heads that people would go and sit on is actually real. And that is very cold.
Now, how cold was it in the way back?
It extremely cold.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it was. Absolutely freezing. It was in Sofia we shot those scenes in the gulag. And brilliantly, the night before we were due to shoot, there was a dump of snow. And so that is all real snow. There's like a metre of snowfall the night before we were due to shoot. So that was very lucky, because when I'd gone up there about a week before to have a look at it, there was no snow. One scene I was meant to do with Jim Sturgis, which I kind of imagined would be looking out of a window, gazing out of a window, was done not only in the snow, but with one of those huge aeroplane engine fans in order to achieve the blizzard. And I could hardly hear myself think. It was Arctic, I have to say, the whole experience.
This is the new Peter Weir film we're talking about, The Way Back. Just explain the why we start in a gulag and just take us through the story.
Well, it's based on a book by a chap called Slavomir Ravit. It's called The Long Walk. And in it, he posits this idea that he escapes from the gulag in the 40s and walks south through Siberia into Mongolia, over the Himalayas and into India. There's some conjecture as to whether or not it's true.
Or whether or not he actually did the walk.
Did the walk. Or another chap called Witold Glinski.
The general feeling is that the walk was done, although whether he was actually one of the walkers is, I think, the issue, isn't it? Because the film begins with the phrase, based on the true story.
Yeah.
Rather than based on a true story, which is Peter Weir was very particular about, the story itself is true, although there's a kind of controversy about the actual genesis of it.
Well, there's also there's the chap who lives in Cornwall, who's a Polish guy, who feels it's his story, not Slavomir Ravitz's story. There's no documentary evidence to support either of them,
sure.
But there is a kind of intelligence services officer who cropped up and said he interviewed a group of people in the 40s, 42,
right,
who were a bedraggled bunch of escapees from the gulag. And then another Pole emerged from New Zealand who said, I was the interpreter at that particular meeting. So certainly something happened. Somebody walked that distance.
From Siberia to India.
Yeah, but who it was, nobody really knows.
And I don't think this counts as a spoiler, okay? Because it's relevant to the story that you're just saying. I think anything that appears over the opening sequence of a film can't be classified as a spoiler. But it does say right at the beginning, this film is dedicated to the three people who did this walk and survived. So they walked the 3,000 miles from Siberia to India. Mm. So I think people will go to this film, which I enjoyed very much, and they'll think, right, so three of them are going to survive then. Is that,
but did it spoil it for you?
It didn't spoil it at all. But it was just an interesting... There was clearly a meeting was held, and Peter Weir and all the production team decided, let's put that at the beginning of the film. And if it had come up at the end of the film, that would have been fine also.
I suppose so. If you'd said at the end, these people made it. But maybe it's because there is the book exists, and the story of the book is the thing that it is based on. So perhaps that's what that's about.
So explain where you fit in. You're Khabarov.
Yes.
Who's a bit of a fantasist, but explain why you're in the gulag.
He's based on a real character, an actor who was put in the gulag for playing aristocracy, which the Stalinist regime decided was bourgeois and unacceptable. So he was he must have been a pretty bad actor too, because he was banged away in the gulag for it. But, that's who he is. He's an actor who's had the temerity to play a member of the aristocracy.
It's a very funny moment, actually, because it immediately started me thinking in terms of, actors whose performances have been so terrible that actually they should be locked up.
We do indeed have the clip of this
moment. Right, okay.
That was why I was doing the kind of... I was making the international sign of the clip. Like, I was going like that.
I thought you wanted to go to the toilet.
You know, I'm not going to put my hand up and ask you for permission to go for a wee.
Here's the clip.
Your charge, may I ask, Janosch?
58-10.
A spy.
Yeah, well, that's what they told me.
10 years?
No, 20.
58-14, sabotage, 10 years. I was an actor. In my last picture, I played
aristocrat. They arrested me when the film was released.
Why?
It was claimed I was elevating the status of the old nobility.
So you got 10 years for a performance in a film?
I've had better notices.
That's great. That sounds like an outtake from Fiddler on the Roof.
Yeah, well,
you want to marry who?
It's great, and it's a really kind of strong, powerful setup. And tell us where it goes from there.
Well, then, what I love about Cabaret, and what Peter actually said to me was what he was fascinated by in that character was that he was like a throwback to the old school character who, in prison movies, would be the guy that knew everything, the one that you'd gravitate to, who was going to lead the escape and know exactly what was going on. And, of course, hopefully, without spoiling it, he's unable to do that at the point when it's required. So he's not actually one of the escapees, but you certainly believe that he's the guy that knows everything. But, curiously, I don't know if this is a particular thing of being in prison, but he feeds off the energy of all the newcomers in order to basically give himself, you know, hope.
Sound like a vampire.
Kind of, yeah. It's not blood. It's the hope of the people that they can escape, the new people coming in that he feeds off. And then the guys go on this this very, very grueling march, 4,000 miles, all the way over to India.
And it's when it starts and it says a Peter Weir film, I was thinking, he hasn't done one for ages. Is it Master and Commander that was
The last thing? Yeah. I mean, the reason I think directors are so important in movies, obviously, as you know, Mark. I mean, because they fashion everything, they take it into the edit, they create it, and so you want to work with the best directors you can. He hadn't done anything since Master and Commander, and then 5 years before that, The Truman Show. So there's only a couple of movies in the last 10 years. So when the opportunity came up to work with him, I didn't really care what the part was or how big it was. I just wanted to be in the film, and it was great. I have to say, working with him was just he's just so knowledgeable, and also fascinatingly, he talks about a lot of stuff in music. I don't know if you did that with you when you chaired the discussion that I couldn't make. I'm sorry about that. But
no, he was great. You were much missed.
He explains things in terms of music, and even when he put together a small piece in order to describe what he intended to do with this film, there was no gulag, there was no mountain. It was like snakes crawling across the desert, and it was really evocative images that he put together, and that's how he pictures stuff, and to work with that is interesting.
He told a fabulous story. I did this onstage thing with him at BAFTA, and two things he said which impressed me enormously. One of them was that when you look at his movies, I mean, it is a really wide range. You know, he's done Truman Show, he's done this, you know, Cars at Paris, Gallipoli, Master and Commander. And what you don't see is like a single overarching style. And I asked him about this, and he said that as far as he was concerned, he had worked really hard to remove any sense of directorial trait. Because generally the feeling is now that an important director, you know, I mean, I'm guilty of saying the same thing. You know, you see 5 minutes of a Cronenberg film, you know it's Cronenberg, you see. But what he was trying to do was to take any stamp of his own work out of it, so that the story was served. And he started saying it's like, you know, pottery in Japan, in which the art is to do with the craftsmanship, and you don't sign it, because what you're saying is that the piece stands for itself, which was very interesting. The other thing he said was he was talking about pitching a movie in Hollywood, and he was talking about the beginning of Witness, in which the whole deal was all done. They wanted to make the movie, they wanted him to direct it, and he was talking about a meeting with the executives, in which he said, okay, now can I tell you the story of the film? And they said, well, no, we know the story of the film. And he said, no, but can I tell you the story of the film? They went, well, all right, go on. And then he started describing for them the opening, in which you see, you know, something which looks very much like a rural setting, and it looks like old-fashioned, and then it comes down on the sign, which tells you that it's today. And he was describing it, and he's saying the whole weird thing is that, as far as he's concerned, that's part of the craft, is to being able to visually tell the story, not what the people say, but what the pictures say. I mean, I thought that is the defining thing when you look through his movies. That's the thing that ties those movies together. He's a craftsman. He is a craftsman, first and foremost. I thought it was a great thing.
And movies are visual images. I mean, ideally. I mean, I remember once I was thinking about going to film school, and the test to get in was, could you take 12 Polaroid pictures that told a story? No dialogue, just pictures. And essentially, you know, that's the bare bones of movies, isn't it?
Yeah,
and that's what he's brilliant at, imagery. But he has this whole thing of music as well. And he's a great guy to work with.
Mark Strong is here. The movie is The Way Back, which we were just talking about before. Thank you for all the emails and texts. And I wonder if, just on the gulag bit which we were talking about, I wonder if now is actually the right time to tell that story again, because it is such an astonishing tale. Indeed, there are two things I want to mention. First of all, Ed Harris's character and the fact there were thousands of Americans who disappeared in the gulags, which I absolutely didn't know. The statistics put out by the film company and the information that they've given us. So in Soviet Russia, 195 million people, 12% of the country were incarcerated. Hmm. That seems utterly unbelievable. 12% of people going through the penal system, which we look at in this film. It's sort of like, it is, okay, people will have forgotten that these gulags existed and this is what they were like, but those are astonishing figures, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it was easy to incarcerate people as well in Siberia, because it's not that they needed particularly useful fences or anything. I mean, if local villagers didn't hand you back if they caught you, then the cold got to you, you know.
Well, that point's made very clear at the beginning, isn't it? The guard, when getting the new prisoners in, takes them to the fence and says, "This isn't your prison," and then points out to Siberia and goes, "That is." Mm. And it is that whole idea that you can get out, but where are you going to go?
Mm. And they didn't have the finances, really, or the resources to manage these things particularly well. So a lot of the guards were fairly brutal, and you could just cram people in. But, yeah, astonishing amount of people to be locked away.
And Ed Harris's character, just a word on that, because to start with, you're going to think, OK, ridiculous. They put an American in there just because, you know, it helps sell it to the American market. But actually, as we mentioned, thousands of Americans disappeared into the camps.
And also, the Slavomir Ravitz, who wrote the book, and this chap, Witold Glinski, who was discovered down in Cornwall, one thing that they share in their stories is a young girl who died on the journey and an American called Mr. Smith. So there seems to be some truth in the fact that if there was an escape, one of them may well have been an American. But, yeah, they were certainly in the camps.
It was interesting. I mean, during the Peter Weir's lecture, somebody asked him, you know, does the character that Saoirse Ronan plays, is that actually based on truth? Because that looks like a device. It looks like, let's put something in to change. But he said, no, that is that is one of the few things we think is absolutely true.
Yeah.
It really was. That girl is based on a real person.
Yeah, they met along the way, yeah.
Paul Kilday, BSc Honours, PhD. "I am a grandson of a Polish man," says Paul, "who was held in both Russian gulags and German concentration camps during World War II. He escaped from both. He gave my mother a copy of The Long Walk, and all five of her children have read it, and it has become very important to us. He told us at the time it was as faithful a representation of what he had gone through, both in capture and in escaping, as he had found. Doubts over whether it was indeed, is it Slavomir Ravitch?
I believe so.
Himself, who went through it, never bothered him, as he said it was the detail of the story that mattered. He died many years ago, but the story always reminds me of him. I hope the film lives up to my and my mother's hopes for it." Well, which puts it in extraordinary context.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely the case. I mean, that was what Peter saw in it as well. And what the sense that you get from the book is just the incredible amount of suffering and the struggle, struggle for human survival. That's what it's really all about. I mean, whether it's one guy or another guy's story or whether it's true or not is ultimately irrelevant. It's an incredible story about, human strength.
I'm also struck by this from Paul Kilday, this email, that his grandfather escaped from the gulag and a German concentration camp. There's a film waiting to be told.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's an absolutely astonishing story. Mm. Have high expectations of this then, presumably, and people will be thinking, great, a Peter Weir film, we've waited a very long time for this.
I hope so. I mean, he's such a master of the cinema. I mean, Dead Poets Society, Witness, I mean, a lot of films we didn't talk about, Picnic at Hanging Rock. I mean, there's so many of them that are so good that you can't ignore the work of somebody like that. And he felt very strongly about this piece, strong enough to make, you know, his first film in 5 years. And he is just a very talented filmmaker, and anything he does needs to be seen.
Dead Poets Society is one of the films we fight about.
Yeah, I can't.
Really?
Stand Dead Poets Society, but it doesn't matter. I still think that Peter Weir... I mean, that's the interesting thing. If Peter Weir had a career making Dead Poets Society, then he and I wouldn't be... But that's the whole point, is that you look at the body of work, and it's very hard. I mean, people find themes. One of the things he often does is, you know, people against very, very hostile backgrounds, alienating landscapes, and that goes right back to Picnic at Hanging Rock, which was recently reissued on DVD and I think Blu-ray for the first time. Mm-hmm. But also this year they had an outdoor screening of Master and Commander, which is a film that really needs to be seen in the cinema, because that's a film that, I mean, it's a really painterly piece of work. You look at that and just the whole screen, that's how you make cinema. It's an extraordinary thing. I mean, I think what's unique about him is that it's hard to think of another director with such, you know, with a marquee name, the name that people would actually recognise, who has striven so hard to take a single distinctive directorial style out of his movies and to make each story look
like the story as opposed to unfilmed a Peter Weir. I thought that was, you know, I think that's really impressive. And the same is true of Way Back. You'd be hard pressed to put the Way Back next to the Truman Show, next to Witness, and say, okay, find me the thing that's the through line. Except that apparently all the actors who work with him say that, and you can verify this or not, he never raises his voice. He doesn't do shouting.
No.
He talks everything. You know, he's not one of those Eric Von Stroheim stomping around. He's the complete opposite of that. He's incredibly quiet.
Yeah, very genial guy. It's almost like making a film with your dad or your uncle or something like that. Somebody you completely trust, who knows what they're doing. And no, he never, ever loses it.
Did you want to express an opinion on the film, Mark?
I like it. I mean, I think that the difficulty that they're going to have with it is almost summed up exactly in what Mark said. It's a film about hardship, and it's a film about struggle. And in the end, those things find audiences or not, depending on how much the audience thinks, OK, it's going to be a triumph of the human spirit, because people, you know, when you're getting people in to see a movie, it's hard for them to say, well, actually, what you're going to see is hardship and struggle. Hmm. I mean, I found the film very moving, and I think in the end, although this kind of seems to demean it, it is about the triumph of the human spirit. But it was interesting having the discussion about whether or not giving away the ending at the beginning is important, because it's not a movie in which what you're doing is wondering, will this person survive, will this person survive, will this person survive. Actually, what it's about for me centrally is that group of people and the interaction between them that changes during the course of the movie, whether they're in freezing conditions or whether they're in a desert or whether they're in the camp or whether they're, you know, towards the end of the film. But I just think it's a very hard thing to sell, right down to the fact that The Way Back is a difficult title. I mean, it's not, you know, people hitting each other in space with lightsabers.
Escape from the Gulag, would that have been better?
Well, actually, in a way, if you'd made the movie in the 70s, that's what you would have called it.
Good point. I think there's always that gulf, isn't there, between good movies and commercialism. I mean, it's
absolutely.
Art and commerce, and it's finding the balance between the two. And what depresses me so much these days is people go online and write about a movie's success in terms of its box office weekend, you know, the opening weekend and how much money it made. And it's so irrelevant, really.
But also, it was interesting. One of the things that Peter Weir was saying was that he has worked outside of Hollywood because there are fewer projects in Hollywood that he would be interested in. Now, of course, one of the things that you made recently was Kick-Ass. And again, they financed that independently and then sold them. They're very, very different movies. But more and more, people are discovering that actually, if you want to make the movie first, fine, you finance it independently and then you see what happens to it. I don't look at The Way Back and think that was a movie made with an eye on the box office. In the same way as Kick-Ass would have been very different if you'd allowed a studio to come in and go, yeah, it's great, but would you mind if the girl was a little bit older and she didn't swear quite so much? Because we think that's going to put people off.
Yeah. Well, I've just done a thing with Jean-Jacques Annaud, you know, the French director, and that kind of doesn't really involve America. More and more, I think, movies are being made, not with the necessity of winning in the American market. The rest of the world is now becoming as important, if not more so. In fact, Robin Hood, I think, made more worldwide than it did in America. So suddenly there's a slight shift going on. So there's a possibility that movies might get made now without a view just of how it's going to do at the box office.
Never has an arrow in someone's back been deserved more.
Thank you very much. I take that as a huge compliment.
It was certainly intended to be a huge compliment.
You were collaborating with the French. That was the main.
Yeah, exactly.
Offense,
that's why
that was it. You know,
I had to die.
Yes,
I remember reading. I think it was last year that you were doing some. Maybe it was Sherlock Holmes, but you'd come out of filming early so you could come back and watch your elder boy in some kind of Christmas presentation or something, and he was Herod or, I don't know, a chocolate Santa or something or something like that. Have you got more Christmas shows to go to, Mark? I mean,
Year he was in The Nativity and he played Joseph, which I was rather proud of.
Very traditional.
And a snowflake. In The Nativity. And but I was away. I didn't get to see it. I've got it on video, which I have to watch. But I was filming in Tunisia, so I couldn't be there, which was heartbreaking. I mean, I would have easily swapped being in Tunisia filming for seeing my boy do his stuff. But I made the first one, which was... I got there for the first one, which was last year, when I think he was a fish or something, if I remember.
The traditional fish.
Yeah.
No, but that's interesting. So to be Joseph and a snowflake, I mean, that's an interesting kind of dual role. It's not Joseph and you've got to be a shepherd, or Joseph and you've got to be a monster or something.
He's opened both shows. So there's obviously something they see in him where they think he's got the balls to get up there and open the show, which is the most terrifying thing you can do.
Where would he get that from?
I don't know.
So what is it that we see you next in? Is it the Arnaud movie that you were talking about, or this
No, that North won't African be for a film. While. In February, there's a film called The Eagle that Kevin MacDonald.
Is that The Eagle of the
shot.
Night?
Yes.
Is it just called The Eagle now?
Now called The Eagle. I mean, okay. we've joked about it. People think that there were eight before, or that it was a golfing movie. But the truth is,
The Eagle of the Ninth Hole.
Yeah, it's just simpler.
And it's not about Don Henley singing Hotel California or anything like that.
Nothing like that at all. It's a boy's quest for his father and the disappearance of the Ninth Legion. So that's out in February. But again, Kevin MacDonald is one of those directors. I think he's really terrific. And then in the
Are
summer,
you bad?
No, I'm not actually. Oh. I'm I'll let you find out. But I'm not a baddie. But then Green Lantern comes out in the summer next June, which is a big Warner Brothers comic book adaptation with Ryan Reynolds. And I'm not bad in that either. I'm forceful. And if they make any more, I turn bad. But that will be an interesting, because that's completely.
Did you see Centurion?
No.
Okay. No, I was just wondering because
I thought they were going to come out about the same time. That there was some talk that Centurion and Eagle of the Ninth were going to clash.
There was a peculiar thing that Centurion got made in with everyone knowing that Eagle of the Ninth was the Eagle. Pardon me, was coming out. And I don't think there's any, I think they're going to be very very different films. But I quite like Centurion actually. You know, I thought it was kind of fun.
Yeah, I haven't seen it, but I think that was more to do with the disappearance of the Ninth Legion. This is more about a young guy being given a command of a unit. He gets injured, he doesn't know what to do with himself, so he decides to go on a journey to find out what happened to his father.
And it's a novel by
Rosemary Sutcliffe.
Yeah, in the 50s. It was a real boy's
classic
own
kids film, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's sort of what's lurking to come out.
Mark, really appreciate you coming to join us. Thank you very much indeed.
Always a pleasure.
You have Christmas off or working?
Tomorrow, I'm flying over to the States with the family.
That's
what
you think.
We're going to go and get some winter sun, unless, of course, the snowfall prohibits it.
Well, there was a tweet came in just a couple of moments ago from Thomas Schaffernacker, who's the BBC weatherman, who was saying, big snow in the south and London expected. So I am not the official word of BBC weather, but there's a lot coming, so you might want to, go now.
Yeah.
Mark, thank you very much. Really, really appreciate that.
Thank you.
Dave Dawes in Buxton, dear Titanic microphone and Clockwork Orange microphone. I had to write in after your warning on last week's programme that you shouldn't listen to more than a few of your podcasts each week. I discovered your podcast 6 months ago and was immediately hooked. My disappointment that the BBC only had a paltry 14 of your podcasts in their online archive was only matched by my excitement that a good friend of mine had every podcast of yours from the last 5 years on his computer.
Oh, don't they self-destruct after a certain amount of time?
A few beers later, says Dave, I became the proud possessor of 294 podcasts,
blimey,
which I have been listening steadily to at the rate of 3 or 4 a day. I cannot confirm that listening to this intensive concentration of Wittertainment is not causing me to hear voices, but as they taught me on my nurse training, just because you hear voices doesn't mean you have to do what they ask you to do. Imagine that. That's a huge back catalogue.
That really is.
Dear Doctors Commode and Condiment, this is from...
What did you just call me?
Commode and Condiment. That's how it's written. Commode.
Oh, I see. Sorry. I thought you were falling into
the old trap.
Yeah.
No.
After all this time.
It's from Peter Shaw.
Fine.
In lieu of our annual school cinema visit, which was sadly cancelled this year, I have been teaching my class of 9 and 10-year-olds the importance of good cinema-going etiquette. We used the Wittertainment Code of Conduct as the basis for our work, although I did edit some parts, notably the Hobbies section.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I have attached a video to show you our hard work. There will be a child-friendly poster created today as well. I hope that this will go some way to enabling Mark's sainthood, as it will take years to happen, but maybe, just maybe, we can change the cinema habits of everyone. Surely that would count as a miracle. Keep up the hard work. St. Anne's Year 5 class and Peter Shaw, who is their teacher. Hello, Peter.
Hello.
Thank you very much indeed for joining us. So, so that's what you sent us. Just explain what you did. We'll play the audio of the video in just a moment. Just explain what your idea was.
Basically, we ended up having to watch a movie in school this year. So, before going in to watch it, we were discussing, how to behave, and it just came to me that actually I've heard a couple of people talking about that quite extensively recently. So, I went on the website and downloaded your little poster, and we used a bit of Tipex, first of all. and then we discussed the various points and did a little video for you to just show you what we've been working on, really.
And we're going to link to your school's website from our website, which will be up in... The link will be up in about half an hour.
So people will be able to go to the 5Live website and see this video that we're talking
about?
Yes,
and it will link to the school's website, so they'll be able to see that. So what was the film that was being shown, Peter?
Well, actually, again, inspired by yourselves, in what's called visual literacy, we've been looking at the Toy Story trilogy.
Wow.
So we finished off with Toy Story 3 yesterday.
Wow, visual literacy. That's
I know.
Going to the movies. as you fancy that, because I'm sure they would have thought, God, come on, sir, can't we just do some English?
Yeah.
Or something. Really, we're going to have to watch Toy Story. All three?
We might treat them with some handwriting practice later.
Oh, OK, all right. So, what did they make of being told of how to behave while watching a film?
Actually, they were remarkably receptive to it. At this age, most of them don't have their own mobile phones, and they're more than happy to say, yes, I hate it when that happens, and, yeah, they were completely with it.
OK, so you made a little film. What we'll do is we'll play the audio from that. So tell, how old are these kids, Peter?
They're 9 and 10.
OK. So this is the audio based on the video, which you'll be able to see from our website. Here are the kids from the Year 5 class at St Anne's in Grantham.
We have been studying
the Wittertainment Code of Conduct.
No phones.
No eating.
No irresponsible parenting.
No picking chairs.
No slurping.
No taking your shoes off.
No arriving late.
No talking.
No hubbies.
No whistling.
Very good, see? And when kids say it, it has so much more power than it does from when we just say about it. So that was a nice little video. What did they make of the whole exercise, Peter?
They quite enjoyed it, yeah. We didn't get round to doing the poster, unfortunately, today. Time got away with us last day of term. But, yeah, they're very into it.
And now you've all broken up, yes?
They're in assembly at the minute.
OK, so is it OK...
15 minutes.
Right, so is it OK that you're not in assembly?
Yes, I've been excused.
They're all in assembly doing what we used to do in assembly, which is have little... You used to do this, you have a little medium-wave radio in your pocket, and then, an earphone... Well, then it was like a single earphone running up inside your blazer, and then you had your hair long enough to be over your ear, so you could stand there in assembly listening to the radio.
Listening to what?
Well, I used to listen to Radio 1 at that point. I mean, obviously not sports, I didn't know what was going on, but you'd have, up on stage, the headmaster would be explaining something important to you, and in your ear would be See My Baby Jive played really quietly through a little track.
How many of your children, Peter, would you imagine are doing that, listening to medium wave on a small portable radio cat's whisker set that they've smuggled
in? Tell you what,
let's
find out. If you're in assembly and listening to this now, put your hand up.
Yeah, I think that's going to be inappropriate behaviour, isn't it?
Is that it? Okay.
Yes, absolutely.
We have had you on the iPlayer just before going into assembly, so I don't know if any of them have got their little iPods or anything.
They're probably singing the school song or something like that, Peter, aren't they? Listen, we wish you happy Christmas. Thanks very much indeed. They're very creative. I think we all wish we were in the Year 5 class at your school.
Merry Christmas to the pair of you.
Thank you. Merry Christmas. Thank you. Peter Shaw, teacher of... Year 5 at St Anne's School in Grantham. What a great teacher.
Very good.
Oh, no, Toy Story 3, sir, please. on the subject of movies to watch at Christmas, now, this time next week we're going to be doing a show which we're recording on Tuesday night, but yeah. It's a live show, so it's the reviews in the first hour, and then a Wittertaining quiz.
Yes, a Wittertaining Christmas quiz, as you nearly said.
That's right, a Christmas quiz. And what we would quite like to do is encourage you to take part in that. I mean, the tickets have been allocated, they have all gone.
Yeah.
But if you want to email...
Yes.
And tell us what your greatest and least favourite, so your favourite and least favourite movie experience at Christmas. Mm-hmm. We'd like to sort of weave that seamlessly into the programme next week.
Do you mean greatest and least favourite Christmas movie or your own experience?
Experience, I think, will expand it out of necessarily just being a favourite film.
Okay, fine.
Otherwise it'll just be people saying the same old stuff.
Sure. And when are you watching It's Wonderful Life this year?
I don't know whether I will watch It's a Wonderful Life.
You might have to.
Well, it's not in the law.
It is.
Is it?
Yes. You can't go through Christmas without watching It's a Wonderful Life.
Well, a number of people have been writing in this week, like this from David Campbell. I intend to watch Bad Santa this weekend. Plus, on the 23rd, take my girlfriend to see It's a Wonderful Life at the Glasgow Film Theatre. She's never seen it before, which is a fantastic position.
Glasgow Film Theatre is a lovely place as well.
Other stuff, essential films to see. I mean, Bad Santa is an interesting kind of counterbalance to It's a Wonderful Life. But stuff that you would recommend would include what?
That I would recommend?
Yes.
Well, I always say that Die Hard is the one to watch around somebody because you always forget that it has a festive...
The first one, yes, absolutely.
The first one. And it really is.
Christmas, melon farmers. Exactly. Wherever you are, farming your melons.
I think when they show it on television now, is it a because also you forget that was Alan Rickman's great big sort of Hollywood starring role as Hans Gruber, and where are my detonators? Now, of course, we know him through many other things, but he was for a long time Hans Gruber in Eyes. I mean, that's the one that I would always recommend. There's both White Christmas and Holiday Inn. You know, you
pays you money, you take your choice. There's the Miracle on 34th Street, various versions. I particularly like the version with Richard Attenborough in it, which I think is really... I do think Richard Attenborough was the best Santa.
The greatest Santa.
Yeah,
of all time.
I do. I think he's fantastic. And it's all his own beard.
Reviews to come, including...
Tron, Legacy, Burlesque, Catfish,
that's it,
and more.
Here come the box office top 10.
Oh, and if anyone's seen No Problem, one sentence would be good.
Bit late for that, as we'll be there within seconds.
No, it doesn't matter. They can still text in one sentence. By the time if we get it in the next few minutes, if you've
seen American, No Problem, the Americans at 10.
It's funny. We had a number of emails about this, about people really not liking it. I saw a couple of people. I think it turned up on their worst of the year list. I mean. I think the problem that they have with The American is that it's not the film that it's been trailed as being. The trailer makes it apparently look like a sort of James Bond-like thriller, and of course it's not. It is much more like, you know, Antonioni's The Passenger. I don't think it's as good as Control, which I think is actually in a way a better story, but I do think Anton Corbin's got a very good eye. It's a solid George Clooney performance. It is hackneyed and cliche-ridden, but I think Anton Corbin brings something to the hackneyed cliches. You kind of enjoyed it as well, didn't you?
No, I did enjoy it. No, yeah. I thought it was good. Yeah. But you understand without seeing the trailer. So.
Sure. I think that's the key thing. I think it's once you've seen the trailer. I mean, a similar thing happened with The Road. People went to see The Road having seen the trailer, which made it look like it was kind of, you know, an apocalyptic, explosive action movie. And then, of course, it isn't. It's a man
in
these... It's a post-apocalyptic thing, which we can't use anymore.
No Problem at 9. No emails in just yet.
Yeah.
Somewhere, Sam from Islington.
Unbelievably
said,
self-indulgent and boring.
I went to see Somewhere at my local World of Sydney last Saturday, says Sam. Cannot remember leaving the cinema so angry. Yeah. I have not been this bored in a cinema since last year's Rachel Getting Married.
At least that was really grating.
In the same way that it is not on for Michael Bay to simply blow things up at the expense of a decent storyline because it's a Hollywood blockbuster, Sofia Coppola cannot make films where absolutely nothing happens under the justification of it being an arthouse film. I had my concerns during the opening scene when the patronising metaphor that was the opening scene with the car doing laps prompted smug laughs of acknowledgement from the oh-so-clever audience. The film could have been a third of the length. As you correctly pointed out in your review, every scene was so much longer than it needed to be, personified by possibly the most unerotic and dull pole dancing scene
twice
ever. I nearly screamed when we had to sit and watch Mr. Dorf whilst sat back in his chair, pick up a piece of fruit, only to wait for it, put it back down again.
Exactly.
Critics seem to be raving about this film, and I can't help but feel that there is an element of The Emperor's New Clothes about it. If it was presented by an unknown director, it would be totally ignored.
The moment when I just lost all patience was when we came back to the pole dancers, which during the pole dancing performance, Stephen Dorff's character falls asleep. And it's like one of those, look! Even the people on screen aren't interested.
Monsters is at number 7. Jack Kirby says, hope you're well. I went to see Monsters last week. I was thoroughly disappointed. I was expecting a sequel to Charlize Theron's 2003 drama Monster, though this time with a whole legion of Charlize Theron's running amok, like Alien and Aliens.
Very good.
Not true. Felix in Norwich, aged 18. After a hard day at school this Wednesday, I braved the cold evening and walked down to see Monsters at my local Odeon. I have to say, it was brilliant. I simply cannot believe that Edwards shot the entire thing on location whilst adding the CGI on his laptop. He is like a new-age Werner Herzog. I think the music score helped immensely, especially in the jungle scenes, to give it that magical quality I think it has, and I wasn't fazed at all with the lack of actual monsters. This wasn't the case, however, with the people sitting on the front row. They all started sighing and groaning, whispering, where are the flipping monsters?
Well, once again, I think, you know, it ties back to the thing we're mentioning with The American, is the difference between the way, and indeed the way back, I think, it's the same issue. Do you sell a movie honestly, or do you sell it in the way that you think will get the audience in? It's very difficult with Monsters, obviously, because the title is meant to be, to some extent, ironic. Obviously, Gareth Edwards, he didn't do those special effects on a laptop. It's a big computer that he's got, but it is a home computer, and I do think he's done a really impressive job. And again, you liked that, didn't you? I mean, you were genuinely impressed.
No, I think it's a terrific film, absolutely.
In terms of how much bangs for his bucks he's got, you know, it's really, that's a £500,000 movie, and it looks really like something. And the fact that they've managed to make the monsters in the background, that's the point, that in the end you end up concentrating on the characters.
So actually, you should say, there are, I mean, I think, and clearly it's not Independence Day.
But there are. Oh, monsters,
but there are
monsters. Yeah, yeah.
They are there,
yeah,
and they're front of house for a lot of the time.
Yeah, they are.
This from Evan. I was wondering, this is in relation to the film at number 6, which is Due Date.
Due Date, yeah. Right.
I was wondering if the movie is still in the top 10, what the Good Doctor's opinion was on one scene in Due Date, where Robert Downey Jr.'s character hits a child and then threatens him with more violence if he tells his parents about it. I thought this was a disgusting scene, especially as it was located in a comedy movie, and the laughter that it enlisted in my cinema to be further proof of our society's impending demise, says Evan, which, you know, who knows about society's impending demise, but Due Date.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. Actually, I didn't laugh at that, and I felt slightly uncomfortable that other people did. I don't want to get po-faced about it, because it is, I mean, it's clearly not real. But no, I agree. I mean, I didn't find that funny at all, and I did think, you know, if you were going through the script, you'd go, yeah, let's not do that. It's just, it's a very, very misjudged moment. I agree.
And so that is at 6. Unstoppable is at 5.
Or Stoppable, as it shall now be referred to under the Trade Descriptions Act. And I hope that's not a plot spoiler.
Megamind.
Can I just say, incidentally, well, Unstoppable is based on a true story, right? The true story has happened in the real world already, in the same way as the way, I mean, it's, you know, based on a true story. There really was a train. It really did run away. There really were two people on it.
Yeah, but
I'm just so... The whole, you know, are you giving the ending away?
Well, I had this years and years ago with George Clooney. We were talking about Perfect Storm, in which, in the course of the interview, made reference to the fact that everybody dies. Because...
Well, that's the point.
I know, that is the point, and it's also an old story. It was much reported. The book was a huge number one. But clearly, there are a lot of people who just come to these things fresh, and they don't want to be told.
But I'm starting to get a little bit hacked off with the constant complaining about plot spoiling. I mean, I agree that one should not spoil a plot, but there are some things in which actually... The revelation of the plot is not the point of the film. It's interesting. We'll confront this to some extent with Catfish. I will be very careful about what I say about Catfish. But the fact is, what happens in Catfish has been the subject of so many news articles that if you don't want to know about it, you probably shouldn't be listening to a review.
Wouldn't it be great to be able to sit behind Jason Assange the next time he goes to
Jason Assange?
Julian, what did I say?
You said Jason Assange, was he Julian's lesser-known brother? Is he in prison as well?
Yes. Julian Isaacs, we say hello to him every single week.
Yes, hello, Julian.
So Julian Assange, the next time he goes to a film, to sit behind him and say, Dumbledore dies. Oh, no, you spoiled it. Sorry, you know, just thought it could be out there.
Yeah, none of them come back.
That would be quite a fun one.
Very good.
Slightly spoiled by getting his name wrong, but anyway.
Yes.
So we have Megamind at 4.
It's all right. It's made me realise how much I think I undervalued The Incredibles when it first came out.
Then we have The Tourist at 3.
And we'll move on to this in a... No, let's do it now, in fact. The Golden Globe nominations. I mean, just shocking. One of the things with the Golden Globe nominations, the whole point is, oh, the Golden Globes understand comedy in a way that Oscar doesn't understand comedy. If you look at the Golden Globe nominations for Best Motion Picture, Comedy or Musical, they are as follows. Okay? Alice in Wonderland, the Tim Burton movie, which I seem to have liked more than most people, but not in a million years will I have put it in a Best Picture category. Burlesque, which we will come to. To which we will come.
Thank you.
The Kids Are All Right. That's fine. Red, which is neither a musical nor a comedy, but is an action movie that happens to have some jokes in it. And The Tourist. I'm sorry, but if you are in any way involved with the Hollywood Press Association, if you had anything to do with the selection of the Golden Globes Awards for Best Motion Picture, Comedy or Music, if you are in any way tied up with this, you should be disgracefully ashamed of yourself. Made in Dagenham, not featured here, okay? Made in Dagenham, which is, you know, clearly, if we're looking at this, is clearly something that ought to be in the Best Musical or Comedy section. No. Red is a better film. The Tourist is a better film. Alice in Wonderland is a better film. You people are shocking. It's outrageous. And, you know, the people that gave an award in 1982 to Pia Zadora, that towering cinematic talent, if you ever...
She's in the attic.
She's in the attic. Exactly. She's in the attic. If you ever, ever, ever doubted that the Golden Globes are based on balderdash and piffle, look no further than this year's nominations for Best Motion Picture, Comedy or Musical. Disgraceful, I say.
Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 1, HP7A, is at 2.
Like it very much.
And the number one film? may contain scenes related. No, you do it.
May contain religious scenes. Thematic scenes.
Thematic.
Yeah, I know. You know what?
I'll come in again.
May contain scenes of religion.
The Chronicles of Narnia, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader.
I think it's the least rewarding or least satisfying of the Chronicles of Narnia movies so far. I like Will Poulter very much. I think he's, so somebody quoted me. Apparently I said last week, that kid's a really fine actor who's going to grow into a really fine actor.
You never said that,
did you? Apparently I did say that. I said it, but I'm sticking by it. But the film itself is very flawed.
The Chronicles of Narnia, though, is the box office number one.
Yeah, and that's fine. And it's not, I don't have a major problem with it.
And to knock Harry Potter off the top, that's sort of some achievement, isn't it?
Well, I think you'd expect it because the gap between Chronicles of Narnia and Harry Potter has been quite, it's at least 4 weeks, isn't it, that Potter has been at number one. I think it's run its course at the number one spot, but it's going to be in the top 10 for a very long time.
Tron Legacies were one of the most talked about films, which comes out this week. Many people, many, many, many decades ago, will have seen Tron, the original. This is not a remake.
The original Tron is, 1982, isn't it? And so the story here is that in 1989, Jeff Bridges Flynn has disappeared off into the grid. He's disappeared, and he's not come back. And his son is now 27. I'm just trying to do the math on adding everything up. His son is now 27. The company is in danger of not being run in the way that it used to be. And then, mysteriously, as if from nowhere, a voice from the past appears. Here's a clip.
Why are you here, Alan? I was paged last night.
Oh, man, still rocking the pager. Good for you.
Yeah, your dad once told me I had to sleep with it. I still do. Page came from your dad's office at the arcade.
So?
That number's been disconnected for 20 years. Sam, two nights before he disappeared, he came to my house. I've cracked it, he kept saying. He was talking about genetic algorithms, quantum teleportation. He said he was about to change everything. Science, medicine, religion. He wouldn't have left that, Sam. He wouldn't have left you.
So, it is unsurprising that what Sam does is to go to the arcade and somehow manage to, push the right button that ends up taking him into the grid. And you remember when Tron first came out? Did you see Tron when it first came out?
As I told you an hour ago.
Okay. The thing, I mean, we all did do the thing about going...
It looked a bit childish. I seem to remember, I just thought...
Tron looked a bit childish.
Yeah, I thought, I can't be bothered with that.
Well,
was it a grown-up film?
Yeah, there was... It suffered from the fact that it was attempting to tap its way into a sort of, a market that had already moved on to some extent. But it was the idea that, wow, look, it looks like a video game. Everyone's playing video games? Well, great. Because I remember when I was at school, we would...
Listening to Wizard.
No, a little bit later on, when I was in the sixth form, we would... leave school ground sometimes on to go to the pub round the corner in L Street, where they had, not to drink, but they had a Space Invaders machine. It was like, wow, Space Invaders. And they had a tabletop Space Invaders. It seemed incredibly futuristic. So you're sort of in that period when anything with sort of graphic light, and of course what they did was they superimposed people's faces onto the, and it was like, wow, people in a computer game, isn't that incredible? It was the most mind-boggling idea. Now, Tron Legacy, I saw at the IMAX cinema in IMAX 3D. I like IMAX very much. I'm not a fan of 3D, as you know. And, of course, what happens at the very beginning when they go into the game, at the very beginning of the movie, in fact, there's the title sequence. You've got the IMAX, you put on the glasses, and everything's coming out and pointing at you. And, well, that's fairly immersive. But very quickly, your eyes adjust to the 3D and it becomes irrelevant. So seeing it in IMAX was a good thing. The 3D I can really live without, frankly. So what happens is he goes...
You must tell us more about that one.
Yeah, he goes into the game where he discovers that Jeff Bridges has basically split into two characters, one of which is the older and wiser father, who in many ways is kind of like playing the Jeff Bridges character from playing the dude, which I have to go back and revisit that movie again. I'm really sorry, I haven't seen The Big Lebowski. I kept promising I would. Another year has gone by and I haven't. The other one is a sort of young, electronically created version of him, Clue, who is the sort of the evil nemesis. Here's the weird thing. All this stuff is going on with... meanwhile, there's another character who's played by Michael Sheen, who's essentially playing David Bowie as a lad insane. For some reason, I'm not entirely sure why, but he literally acts and performs and looks like David Bowie's lad insane, even right down to the sort of feather cut at the back with the, and all the stage movements. And that's fine. The film costs something like $200 million shot. I think the deal is that they shot it for 60 days and then they post-produced it for 64 weeks. When it was first announced, they showed a trailer at some convention, and the trailer predated the film, and the idea was if they mocked together a trailer they would see whether there was any interest in the movie. And of course they mocked together the trailer and they put it up, and suddenly people went, wow, yeah, god, Tron, fantastic, because everybody thought, isn't Tron old hat, does anybody care anymore, hasn't the Tron boat sailed already, surely all the people who are old enough to remember Tron are old enough not to be interested in going to see Tron Legacy anyway. They said, so they played this trailer, there's massive interest. So in a way the film itself was generated by fan interest. Also, that kind of gives you a clue as to what the problems with the film are, is that it's a film that was generated by a trailer, and although there is a certain nostalgic charm in it, it very, very quickly loses its way. It's amazing that for a film that has quite so much special effects going on, quite so much thrown at the screen, quite so much sort of, I mean, there is still a sort of nostalgic goodwill appeal about that idea of going into a computer game. You know, there is still something about, oh yeah, what would it be like? You get there and suddenly there are all these other characters and they're all, and they're electronic and you've got to find. So that still kind of appeals to me in exactly the same way as it did back in 1982. You know, although I don't play computer games now, the idea of the video arcade game, going into a video game, it's like The Last Starfighter and all those sort of things. It, you know, if those things were real, that's a charming idea. The problem is that very quickly, the plot sort of runs out of steam. And I was surprised at sitting there watching it on an IMAX screen, in a 3D IMAX screen, with a great big volume. The screen couldn't be any better. The picture couldn't be any better resolved. I think it was one of the very first screenings of it, thinking, I'm actually quite bored. And why am I bored? Am I bored because the characters aren't very interesting? Am I bored because the plot's kind of a little bit ripping? You've got to get to that, and you've got to get to that, and he's got to do the thing, and then he's got to set up the meeting with the other thing, and then he's got... And then you start concentrating on all the things that are wrong with him. And the thing which is most remarkably wrong with the film is that despite everything else that they can do with all these incredible graphics, they've managed to get Jeff Bridges, right? And they've done a young version of Jeff Bridges' face, and then he goes in, he has his face scanned, which of course actually happened, you know, in the original film. He has his face scanned, and then he acts in a, you know, one of those digital rooms, and then they get an animated version of young Jeff Bridges acting on screen. So it's like, okay, fine, the years just float away and you're exactly what you used to be like as Jeff Bridges, except for the fact that they can do everything now, right? They can do exploding buildings, they can do flying planes, they can do dinosaurs, they can do velociraptors, they can do whales, they can do whatever he wants. But the thing they can't do is mouths. What is it with human mouths that all the time the Jeff Bridges thing is trying to talk about this? He looks like Cher in Burlesque. He looks like, for some reason, I can't open his mouth. It's like the wide mouth frog joke. It's like you think he's running the whole film. Jeff Bridges is going to say, oh, you don't see many of them around, do you? It's really, really peculiar. And I remember seeing the 3D version of Beowulf, which, of course, is all digital characters all running around, you know, stripped to the waist and, you know, rippling torsos. But the one thing they can't do is their mouth. And it's a bizarrely distracting thing. And I started to wonder, am I obsessing about the fact that they can't do his mouth properly because the film isn't interesting enough to take my mind off that? Or am I wondering about it because it is something beyond which I cannot get in order to be engaged in the film? And I decided that it was the former. That when you're watching a movie that's that big, that's got that much special effects going on, that's got that much nostalgic, you know, that sort of wellspring of appeal to draw on, hey, look, we're bringing back Tron, everyone loves Tron, you know, it's Tron, it's great, it's Jeff Bridges, you know, coolest man alive, all these things are going on, and you are sitting there worrying about the fact that the young Jeff Bridges' mouth isn't moving properly, what does that tell you about the film? What it tells you about the film is that for all the stuff that they're throwing at it, for all the special effects, for all the, you know, the Doppel soundtrack, for all those things that they're trying to get right, the film is oddly dull. And I say oddly dull because it's not dull like Michael Bay's Transformers is dull, because it's just smashing and thumping and crashing and bashing and meat-headed nonsense. It's oddly dull because I like the visual design of it. I like the idea of it. I like the kind of the neon lit quality of it. As I said, there's something oddly charming about it all, and yet the charm just starts to plod and drag, and I'm just sitting there worrying about electronic Jeff Bridges' lips, which is not good.
On the subject of Tron, loads of people have seen it already in various screenings and previews, sure, and so on. Philip in Basingstoke, I loved the original when it first came out, and I love Daft Punk. The two together is a giddy concept, and he's hoping that you didn't slate it. Well, you didn't slate it, you just found it boring. James from Barhead. I work in a school as a support assistant, went to the nearest World of Cine with the pupil and teacher I work for as a Christmas treat. A morning showing of Tron was the obvious choice, and it did not disappoint. Great performances from Bridges and Sheen, amazing special effects, and a simply stunning soundtrack from Daft Punk. An Oscar is surely in the bag for them, says James. Saw Tron Legacy a couple of weeks ago at a preview. Visually, it was an absolutely fitting setting. This is at the Leicester Square Empire, with the enormous screen making the film look incredible, but everything else about it, script-wise, is really bad. Simon, I saw Tron at 5:05 today, and I am so pleased to report it is fantastic, and I wasn't expecting much. Kenny in Milton Keynes.
Well, so that's generally people being much more positive about it than I was.
Indeed.
Generally, people seem to have liked it a lot. I mean, I'm sorry. Believe me, I was excited. I went in with a childlike enthusiasm for it. I went in wanting to like it, but I'd be lying if I told you I didn't get bored. And I didn't. And I didn't think, why am I bored by this?
James, Call My Name and I'll Be There, Taylor, says, could you please ask Mark to cast some of his magical, ranty, healing spirit over the airwaves and ask him to try and fix me before 8:30 this evening? I'm a nerd. I've been waiting for the Tron sequel for some time. I've booked my tickets, but today I've been struck down with some horrendous, shivery, aching coffee cold. So the interesting thing about, clearly, a lot of the correspondence is that this is a film that people have been looking forward to.
That's what I mean about the goodwill. There's that wellspring of goodwill that is definitely there, and it was there with me as well. I wanted it to be good. I wanted it to be better than it is. And as I said, it's not terrible. There are things in it that are charming and nostalgic, but it's just oddly boring. And I wish that that weren't the case. And I saw it, believe me, in the best possible circumstances, other than the fact that I saw it in 3D. It could have been improved by seeing it in IMAX without the 3D.
Darren Pemberton says, Dear Simon and my jiving baby, that'll be you.
Okay.
I need help with a dilemma about your upcoming film fest. This is a reference to our Tuesday recording of Christmas Eve's programme. Imagine my delight to learn on my very first attempt I successfully secured tickets for me and my film-loving teenage son, James, A-level film and media, to see you and the good doctor live in London, only to learn that my wife has booked us in for a birthday curry the same night at the Balti Hut in Bidford-on-Avon. I really need a credible and marriage friendship-saving excuse for being somewhere else. The dilemma is that the curry celebrates my birthday, says Darren Pemberton, 49 years and 4 days. So he wants to come to our show and has tickets, but his wife has booked him in for a curry to celebrate his birthday.
Let's try the old, it's my birthday and I'll go if I want to.
That's not really very cleverly thought out, though, is it? Okay, maybe people can come up with something better. Can anyone help Darren Pemberton? Although maybe they're thinking, if he can't go, maybe I can have his ticket.
How about, I know that you don't really like curry, but you're taking me there as a kind gift to me, and my gift back to you is to say thank you for that. Let me take you to something that you'll enjoy more.
But you're assuming that Mrs. Pemberton doesn't like curry. Mrs. Pemberton may indeed really like curry.
Yeah, well, in which case, you're kind of on a hiding to nothing, aren't you?
Also,
he's
not bringing Mrs. Pemberton.
How about
he's bringing his teenage son.
No, and Mrs. Pemberton.
No, just teenage son.
On his birthday, he's going to leave Mrs. Pemberton behind?
Yes.
Oh, the rotter.
Six reviews to come of Burlesque, amongst others. We did have a conundrum from Darren Pemberton, who wants to come to our show on Tuesday night and not go for the birthday curry. Ian Preston has suggested he just gets a takeaway and brings it down. Although, would that break the code to eat? I think it would, because eating
us.
A curry... But normal rules don't apply. I mean, people could just suck croissant. That would be quiet enough, would it?
But, yes. Yeah, and it's... Yeah, I think that's fine. But, I mean, you can't... It's the hot and steamy food, isn't it? That's the smelly food you're not allowed to take in.
This says, play the son card and say it would be great for him and his studies.
Yes, that's it. That's the money.
Most
well
mothers put their sons first. I always do, says Carol in
Top
Coventry.
Yes.
So I would love to come
for a curry with you, but it's more important that we get our child's education
sorted
out. It's not about me.
It's about him.
Yeah. Enough about me. Let's talk about you. What do you think about me?
Tron from Kevin. Kevin Riley says, being an enormous fan of Tron since first seeing it as a wide-eyed 12-year-old, I have been following developments of the forthcoming Tron Legacy in eager anticipation.
Years,
it is rare for any movie to be given a follow-up 3 decades later. However, now that the release date of September 17th is upon us...
September 17th?
Did I say that?
Yes, you did.
December the 17th. Very good. It's nearly upon us. The wind has been completely taken out of my solar sails by the discovery that the overwhelming majority of cinemas have packed their schedules solely with the 3D version. The 2D version is nowhere to be found. Neither my wife nor I have functional stereoscopic vision, and the result when forced to watch a 3D movie, is a combination of eye strain, motion sickness and blinding headache.
Yeah.
Needless to say, we will not be enjoying Tron Legacy on the big screen unless we can find a cinema showing a 2D print. And he goes into great detail about it. He's tried to find one.
Yeah.
He says, we're in the northwest of England, a stone's throw from one of the largest multiplexes in the area, which has a total of 16 screens. From the 17th, Tron Legacy is scheduled in about half a dozen of them, but only in the 3D version. Call me cynical, but for such a strongly hyped film, which is almost guaranteed to put large numbers of bums on seats in its opening weekend, the idea of an extra quid or so per ticket for the 3D glasses can't have gone unnoticed. So he's basically just
made it. Yeah, I agree. I wish that I had seen it IMAX in 2D. I don't know if there is a 2D IMAX print, but I wish there had been.
So, what else is new if we're not going to see Tron Legacy?
Apparently one of the five best motion picture comedy or musicals of the year, Burlesque. And here we are. Here's an advert for it with a picture of Cher's strangely plastic face. Three Golden Globe nominations, including Best Picture. So, the story is... Christina Aguilera is the new kid in town. She walks into a burlesque bar and doesn't really kind of know what it is, but she knows she wants to be a singer and a dancer. And the next thing you know, she's going to get her feet under the table and she is going to become the new burlesque star. Here is a clip.
Hey, Dave, cut it! Hold on a second. I can do this.
And I think that it's sweet that you think you can.
Just tell me what you're looking for.
I'm looking for someone who can do the routine.
You're gonna make me believe that you belong up there. You want to show me something? Show me that.
All right. Which number do you want to see? I know every single one of them.
You know every single number.
Which one do you want to see? What's going on?
You know, you were off the whole last half.
Oh, come on, Tez. Come on. I'll practice till I bleed. I know I can do this.
You know, we have better dancers.
Well, say thank you very much and goodbye.
Didn't anybody ever give you a shot in life? Please. I want this so bad. If you just give me a chance, I...
All right. God. You got the job.
What are you so excited about? She's your replacement.
Very brief snippet in there of Stanley Tucci doing his best gay friend role that he seems to do rather well. Now, what to say about Burlesque? Basically, if you want to remake Showgirls for 12-year-olds, then here it is. If Showgirls had any appeal at all, it was that it was so spectacularly vulgar and crude that it was possible. And in fact, I've heard Paul Verhoeven do this. There was an argument made for Showgirls that actually its virtue was that it was the most misanthropic view, not only of its particular subject, but of the human existence in living memory. And in fact, I know that some people sort of fell into loving Showgirls as a camp classic. It became a sort of one of those movies which people sort of found and would shout out the lines. But Verhoeven himself says that the reason that Showgirls was rejected, I think this is a debatable point, was that it's so horrible, so vulgar, so vile, so nasty about all the people involved in it that actually people just couldn't get a handle on it. Well, obviously there's just no nastiness or anything in the case of Burlesque. What you get with Burlesque is what we are now tending to get seasonally at this time of year, which is the seasonal release of the rubbish musical. I mean, last year it was Nine. Do you remember Nine? Which was, you know, basically meant to be an homage to all those Italian films. And, you know, there was that song, Be Italian, how should we be Italian? Wear a thin tie, smoke cigarettes and have a coffee, drive a Vespa and say, ciao, ciao, Bella, be Italian. No, that
what
fine.
Is that, what is that tune?
It's the tune called Be Italian. From the movie Nine. It really is. I'm not making it up. There really is a song. Be Italian.
Yeah, okay.
Have little pointy shoes. Be thinner than most people and look good in your clothes. Be Italian. Have a corrupt political system. Anyway, okay. So, and this, right, Burlesque is full of songs with be burlesque, yeah, shake burlesque around. Be a little bit burlesque, a little bit risky, a little bit less or more for burlesque. Has less but more is what's the less and more important. And Cher spends the whole movie doing this thing, she's got Jeff Bridges' mouth, clearly, from Tron. She spent the whole movie talking like this, and she says in the press notes, they had to ask her many times to be in the movie, and clearly, I mean, she's in the movie, but her face isn't. Her face has not.
Why is that?
Because her face is completely immobile.
Why is that, though?
I don't know. I've got
Simon,
I'm not even going to speculate as to why it is that Cher is unable to move any of her face.
You remember that famous Clive Anderson interview where Clive said, you look $1 million, is that how much it cost?
Very good. Very good. The other thing I think about this on a slightly more... I mean, Alan Cumming is in there, which kind of, you know, so obviously...
That's a surprise.
Yes, I know. But, you know, apparently he was very good in Cabaret.
Yes, he was.
And he sort of does like an incredibly watered down version of that here. He gets the riskiest number in the film, which involves a banana. And that's, you know,
it's
that's
the riskiest.
The riskiest. The most risque. I was trying to figure out what the most risque in the thing. But, you know, honestly, the idea that this has any connection to the great legacy of Cabaret or any other thing is completely absurd, even though Alan Cumming's there. The worst thing about it, I think, is apart from the fact that the songs are boring, the dialogue is terrible. I mean, the dialogue literally consists of, oh, who's that? It's the new girl. Oh, she's not getting my chair. Oh, no, she is going to get my chair with her mutant lungs. What are you going to do? I'm feeling a little bit jealous. I think I'll have to... You know, there's a moment when the jealous girl cuts the power so that our heroine is on stage with no power. Everyone else is lip syncing. Okay, and she said, "Why can't we sing? Oh no, they don't come here to sing. They come here to watch you lip sync." Okay, so she cuts the power, and then Christina Aguilera starts singing, "I'm a singer. I will sing, although there is no power." And Cher cuts to Cher, goes, "Hold the curtains." And then Christine does the song, and everyone goes, "Wow, she's the new star of burlesque." And I go, anyway.
You just headbutted your small microphone.
My small microphone. The worst.
That's why we don't give you a bigger one.
The worst thing is that if you look at, I mean, burlesque, schmurlesque as far as I'm concerned, but there have been a few movies about it recently. There was Burlesque Undressed, and then we just had On Tour, the Matthew Amrick film, which I actually liked a lot more than I think. I think once it's got to the point that you've got the 12-rated Burlesque and Christina Aguilera, and well done to the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, apparently one of the 5 best musical or comedy films of the year, at least the positive note is no one's going to go near Burlesque again. That's it. It has been officially taken from the underground movement that it apparently once was and brought into the overground movement in a way that will mean everyone will be thoroughly sick of it within 3 months and will presumably not hear any more about it.
Or it'll be a huge success.
Burlesque 2.
Yes. Further Burlesque.
Yes. Further Burlesque.
Yeah, that would work.
Burlesquer.
Edward.
Burlesque and Burlesquer.
I think we should say hello to Edward Moyes.
Hello, Edward Moyes.
Who's stuck in Geneva Airport trying to fly back to London.
He says,
I've managed to find a free Wi-Fi and I'm listening live for once. And I'm hoping that the Tron review is still to come. I'm hoping that it doesn't end up as being a stinker. Well, Edward, let me tell you that you've missed the Tron review. And it wasn't exactly
a stinker. It wasn't a stinker. It's just boring.
What you need to do, Edward, is to, when you get back in a few days, check out the iPlayer or the podcast. You might be able to download the podcast. If you're still at Geneva Airport, you could probably download it from there. I'm sure they'll let you do it. Just go to the website and everything will be fine.
The other thing about Burlesque is I spent an awful lot of the movie thinking, wow, Hayden Christensen is doing something I haven't seen him do before. And then it turned out that's because it wasn't him. It was this other guy, Cam Gigandet.
Does he look like Hayden Christensen?
No, Simon, I just thought it was Hayden Christensen because it just popped into my mind.
Dear Tron and Burlesque, says Jamie in Stanmore, just a quick message to say that Dr. K's review of Burlesque was one of the best rants of the year. Well, we haven't got to Fred yet, not that I'm prejudging that, of course. So where do we go next?
Catfish, one of the most talked about films of the year. The tagline for Catfish says, "Don't let anyone tell you what it is." So I'm going to attempt to work within the confines of that. It's either a documentary or is it? There's been a lot of questions about how honest a documentary it is, how much of it, if anything, is staged. From the press notes, it says it is a riveting mystery that's a product of our times, a remarkable and powerful story of grace within a labyrinth of online intrigue. Essentially, two filmmakers, Ariel Schulman and Henry Joost, documenting Ariel's brother Neve's unfolding relationship with a strange family. He is a photographer. At the beginning of the film, he receives a painting done from one of his photographs by an 8-year-old girl. He then gets in touch with her and her mother and strikes up an online relationship with them, and then strikes up an online relationship with her stepsister, with whom his relationship becomes more and more sort of intense and intimate. And then at a certain point in the documentary, wondering how all this is going to pan out, they decide to make the journey to meet the people they have only known online up until now. Here's a clip.
Her sister Megan is an artist and also a dancer, but she isn't making as much art, or only shared this picture with me because I think she's a big crush on me. And so when I made that my Facebook profile picture, she really liked it and told me how like nice it was and that she thought how nice it would be to put her head on my chest and fall asleep. So then she drew it, and it's actually a beautiful drawing.
Yeah, it is.
So here's the stuff that needs to be said about this. Without wishing to give away the plot, and people have said, please don't give, so I'm trying my hardest. It'll be no surprise to discover that things are not as they seem. The documentary, therefore, purports to be about the way in which online relationships intersect or don't intersect with reality. It is produced by Henry Dricke, who, of course, is famous for capturing the Freedmans, which, again, was one of those, you know, it's somebody who's well-versed in documentary and blurring the lines around the edges of documentary. I think the things that are important are, firstly, the questions we ask, is it true? Secondly, if it is true, have all the participants agreed to the film being made, which apparently they have. Thirdly, is it in any way taking advantage of any of the participants, some of whom seem less emotionally stable than others? And fourthly, if all the above are true, is it then engrossing or interesting, and does it tell us something about the online community? I mean, a lot of people have actually matched this up thematically with Social Network. They said in the year in which Social Network is out, it's interesting that this film is out. I think a better comparison would be like with something like The Arbor. I mean, it's been a funny year. We've had films like I'm Not and I'm Still Here, you know, which is the documentary, or was it a documentary, about, you know, an actor apparently disowning acting and going into rap, but then nobody really believed that that was what was happening. And at the end, everyone said, oh, no, the whole thing was a setup job. But The Arbor is this British movie in which you have actors lip syncing to actual testimony, people who knew Andre Dunbar, the playwright. And I think that, as far as this year is concerned, has been the most interesting examination of the line between drama and reality, between fiction and reality, between drama and documentary, between what's constructed and what is actual. All the way through Catfish, there is a feeling of unease, partly about the filmmakers themselves, who, and since they have cut the film, I think they're obviously aware of this, come across as slightly creepy. There is also an unease in the back of my mind in wanting to... The question that you have to ask yourself is, in order for this drama to play out the way it does, which works very well for the film, it looks like there is an active refusal at the beginning of the film to actually find out more than they know. If the people are as online literate as they are, how come they didn't figure right early on that things weren't as they seem? And it seems to me that there is an element of artifice in this, which is that they deliberately didn't know. Because obviously what they're aware of is there was a possible interesting story going on here about an online relationship with people who may or may not be what they say they are online. And consequently, the minute you solve that problem, the documentary falls apart. I thought it was engrossing, and I thought it was interesting. I thought it was creepy. I thought that there were moments in it in which I felt uncomfortable about the way in which the people on screen were portrayed. There were other moments in it in which I thought, actually, I don't buy. I think they are putting this on. In a way, I wish I could get that stuff out of the way and just talk about the story itself. But in the end, it is much more a story about constructed documentary than it is about anything else. And I would say, if you're interested in that area, don't go and see Catfish. It's perfectly fine. It's an interesting film. It's not a brilliant film. It's an interesting film. The press writing about it has made it into more of a sensation than perhaps it should have been. But if you're really interested in that, check out The Arbor. However,
Nigel Boothman in Edinburgh. I saw a trailer for Fred the Movie last week.
Oh, blimey.
Which is where we're going next.
Yes,
the evening after your show, in fact, and I knew within seconds that Mark was going to do the horrible Fred voice when he reviewed it. I pondered all week whether or not to listen this week because I knew it would be ghastly, but I thought I'd better give you a chance, and I did. I've just turned on. How long before Mark did the voice? 11 seconds, I think, and he's done it twice already. This is my first and last plea to your sensitive side. Please don't do it again. Explain that the character has a monumentally annoying voice and leave it at that. People will understand and I will remain a loyal listener. Come on, I've got two kids under three and I get enough of this screeching at home without listening to a grown man with massive hands doing it on the radio.
Listen,
says Nigel.
I had to sit through Fred. Okay, here's for those who don't know, and I didn't in advance, okay, Fred is an internet sensation. Apparently, according to the channel, his channel, he's a young guy, right, who has this character, Fred, who when he does him on the internet has a speeded up high-pitched voice, who's young,
playing younger than he actually is. And apparently by April 2009, the channel had over 1 million subscribers, making it the first YouTube channel to hit 1 million and the most subscribed channel at the time. The Fred channel has received over 96 million channel views and over blah, blah, blah. Fred is the second most viewed comedian of all time, being the most popular YouTube channel amongst 13 to 17 year olds in the UK. So I have subsequently gone back and looked at some of the Fred things on YouTube, in which they're shorter, obviously they're, you know, 3 or 4 minutes long, in which Fred is talking like this, he's doing this kind of voice. Now, in the movie, the deal is this guy who's playing this annoying hyperactive kid is with us for 90 minutes, and the voice is slightly different, and the shrieking is turned up. And what happens is, I mean, it's very rarely that I've got to the point and think, I've got to leave, I've got to go. The thing isn't funny, for a start, but it may be funny in three-minute segments, and I understand that huge numbers of people find Fred funny on YouTube. Believe me, Fred on YouTube, from what I've seen of it on YouTube, is not Fred the movie. Fred the movie is like being in the room with the sound of fingernails scraping down a blackboard, with the sound of Velcro ripping, with just everything that possibly could put you... And what happens is that as Fred... He's talking to the camera. But the most annoying thing about the Fred character is that he screams and shrieks, and he literally goes, "Aah!" And he does that, and he keeps doing his...
Sorry, guys.
It's going by, and he's going...
He's apologising to the engineers and the listeners. Sorry, Nigel.
No, I'm sorry. How long this... Okay, fine.
We've got the message. No, you can stop now.
No,
you can stop.
I want to give you an example.
I might fade you out. Stop. Fade him out.
That was 5 seconds.
Fade him out.
That was 5 seconds.
See, I can fade you out. Now fade him back up again.
5 seconds.
Too much.
Right? I had 90 minutes of
I don't
that.
Care.
How many 5 seconds in a minute?
You're paid to go and
many
see these films.
Many 5 seconds.
You don't
in a
have
minute.
To inflict the worst
I
bits.
I took stuff and put it in my ears. I was gripping the bottom. I was doing everything to not leave. I don't leave. I don't walk out of movies. I don't. I have to say, along with a Serbian movie, it's my least favourite viewing experience of the year. It was like...
People might have walked out of people.
And at the
it's
end,
like,
people
what?
Would give. It was like.
I'm going to walk out of this review in a minute.
Oh, no, it's fine. It's fine. And you've been in the room with me. Go. In fact, the impression of Fred the movie is going to drive you out. I had to stay.
You have lost your microphone. You have lost your broadcasting rights. You are no longer a broadcasting legend.
Very quickly.
No.
Also out this week. Also out this week is an Italian movie called Loose Cannons, which is directed by Ferzan Ozpetek, who made Turkish Bath. It's a story about two brothers whose father runs a pasta industry. Neither of them want to take over the pasta industry. One of them comes to the other one and says, "Look, what I'm going to do is I'm going to announce to our father that I'm gay. And then he's going to disinherit me and I can get on with my life." And then just as he's about to do it, the other son announces that he's gay.
I've just got a ringing in my ears, so none of this makes any sense.
And it's a funny little thing. It's a very strange little drama. It's kind of sweet, kind of charming, kind of all over the place in some places, but oddly sort of free-spirited and unpredictable, and I enjoyed it more than I thought I was going to. And certainly a lot more than Fred.
Yeah. Have you quite finished?
I have.
No, do not start. Can I just say, our Christmas Eve show next week, which we are recording on Tuesday night with Dave Morrissey and Hugh Bonneville, if you do that, we will edit it out because it was amongst the worst moments of radio this year, OK? Do not do it again.
90 minutes I had.
Do not do it again.
You wouldn't have lasted. You would have left.
I would have walked
out. You would have walked
out of that
But
review.
I sat there... Blah!
Stop.
I'm not going. Fade him out.
Well, I can only apologise for that final sequence, which, as I said, does contain the worst broadcasting I have heard and the most irritating sequence. I mean, Danny Dyer, in comparison, you know, you can do that.
So right. I tell you, that would be there. That would be the perfect storm. Danny Dyer stars in Fred the movie.
Let's hope it doesn't happen ever.
And for those who are just listening to this on the podcast and don't have the advantage of pictures, Simon did leave the studio. He's now clearing up. Yeah. Did leave the studio and then come back in and remove my microphone.
Because it was criminally
away
terrible.
From the microphone.
Thank you very much indeed for listening. We'll bring you our Christmas special next week.
On digital and online. This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
bbc.co.uk/5Live.
You can get more of my film reviews, anecdotes and opinions by visiting my Uncut blog. Head to www.bbc.co.uk/Mark Kermode.